AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Hey guys, it's your favorite sisters with the Confessions of a Reluctant Caregiver show on UK Health Radio. On the show, you'll hear caregivers confessing the good, the bad, and the completely unexpected. You're guaranteed to relate, be inspired, leave with helpful tips and resources, and of course, laugh. Now, let's jump right in to today's guest confession.
Hey, Jay.
Hi, Natalie.
I would sing the good morning song to you, but it's afternoon, which means we're going to be extra punchy.
It is extra saucy, and I don't think you know an afternoon song.
No. Well, actually, isn't there Afternoon Delight?
What is that one song from the 70s? That's like a love song or something. I don't want to hear that.
That seems inappropriate. We immediately went downhill. Okay, I'm not going to sing Afternoon Delight. I have to think of something else. But to Neil, who is our guest, by the way, which is
yes, we have a guest.
He's a boy. You know,
let me do my voice.
It's a boy.
We have a boy for the guest today. Like we recorded earlier and we had another boy, and it shows you that it's more common than people think of, because people think of caregiving, Jay, as a female dominated role. And
absolutely.
It has been, I mean, it's been built into the culture of our society for hundreds of years, honestly, hundreds and thousands of years, probably. I would have fallen into the hunter gatherer group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 20,000 years ago, I would have preferred to be the hunter gatherer, because everybody knows I can't pull water. So my line would have passed out really down really fast. Just gone. Okay.
You're a mess. So let me get started.
I want you to talk about Neil, and because Neil is going to be super fun. I can already feel it.
Absolutely. Because he showed up in Scrubs.
Oh, that's right. Oh my gosh. You got to watch the video.
Yeah, the video is worth it.
Go to YouTube and watch this, because Neil's wearing the outfit that every one of us want to wear every day.
Scrub. Absolutely. So let me introduce you guys. We are honored, absolutely, to have Neil Shaw with us today. He has an incredibly impressive background, but his best title, he is a CEO, but he's America's Chief Elder Officer.
I'm not going to lie to you. Freaking love that. Like, I'm the Chief Energy Officer. The fact that I found the Elder Officer, dig it.
Totally. His book, he has like the best titles. His book is titled Insured to Death: How Health Insurance Screws Over Americans and How We Take It Back. So I'm like, dude, he totally pegged it for me too. He helped care for his grandfather through multiple diagnoses and end of life, but he also cared for his wife through years of cancer and serious illness. Those events inspired him to leave his career and start a caregiving movement. I'm telling you guys, that is spreading nationwide.
He was a big quitter and did something bigger.
I know. So Neil, we are so excited to have you here. Thank you so much. We follow you. Yay! You're like an icon. Yep. You're like LinkedIn. Like,
honestly, if you don't follow Neil on LinkedIn, you should, because just insightful, fantastic post. And I'm going to tell you, I feel smarter when I read things from him. So we'll make sure his information's in the show notes to get connected with him, because he's doing all kinds of cool stuff. But all of this came about from his past experiences. And so now we need Neil to tell his story. So Neil, I always start off with start from the beginning. You were born, but give us some background. Give us some background about your family and growing up and how care came into your life. But you got to give us some color so we know some things.
Yeah, sure. First of all, JJ and Natalie, thanks so much for having me. It's really an exciting opportunity. Yeah, I mean, I guess where do I begin? I grew up like pretty humble beginnings. I was born in India. Actually, my family immigrated to the U.S. When I was a young child. And, you know, then grew up here under like pretty modest circumstances, you know, it's like oftentimes the life of immigrants is like starting over, you know, so, you know, lived in like pretty lower income household through most of my childhood and all the way kind of through high school. Was like a pretty good like academic, you know, student. So ended up going to university and getting some scholarships and, you know, then graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. And yeah, initially started my career working in finance. I mainly just as a way to like repay some college loans and kind of like, what's the fastest way I can earn income. And, you know, it's like really good at it. You know, very quickly out of school, I went into investment banking in New York City, you know, was top of the class there and got recruited by a hedge fund. And, you know, there I learned very quickly how to do turnarounds of troubled companies and invest in and find opportunities pretty quickly. Over the course of 3 or 4 years, became a partner at a multi-billion dollar fund where I was running the entire restructuring and kind of turnaround portfolio. Wow. And then I just happened to kind of catch a lucky break in my career where 2008, 2009 financial crisis happened. And I was the only person at the firm that knew how to like do bankruptcies and turnarounds. So I ended up getting allocated a lot of the firm's capital to investments that I was finding.
How old were you at that time? I have to jump in.
27.
I'm like, Natalie. I was going to say, because you're young.
I'm in my early 40s now. Yeah. I was 27 at the time. So it was like massive like career break. I mean, don't get me wrong. I was like good and I was working hard, but sometimes you just get lucky, you know, like right place, right time. So I generated a lot of returns for the fund. And as a result of that, at 31, when I was 31, one of the investors approached me to start my own investment organization. So I started that.
Wait. You're going way too fast though, Neil.
Okay.
You skipped over like the fundamentals of where you get like this passion. Like,
I want to go personal.
I need to know if you got siblings.
Oh, yeah.
I need to know.
Yeah,
no, I don't care about work. I need to know about like, tell me where
personal,
this heart for care and serve came from. And to me, I think
we
started with like, my parents were immigrants. We came to the United States.
Yeah.
Like, I need to know where you're from. If you have any siblings.
Yes.
Talking about childhood and family values and things, because I think so much of caregiving comes from our past experiences,
good or bad.
And so, because it shows your heart, my friend, not just your brains.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. And I always tend to kind of like lead with that stuff, but you're right. Like, I think in like thinking about like how, you know, who am I? Like, I'm a combination of my mother and my father, and they're quite different personalities, you know, and like they're it's very symbiotic, but, you know, I learned a lot of my analytical mindset from my dad, you know, who's like a very analytically oriented person. And I learned a lot of care from my mom, and both of whom I'm like very close to and spent a lot of time with in my childhood, and also my grandparents. You know, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, and, you know, they all have like different personalities. But yeah, I'd say I learned a lot of care and empathy. Actually, interestingly enough, like, I'm like a pretty spiritual person, and I do like believe in like a greater power. And sometimes I believe in like destiny and fate. And one of the things that's been reinforced to me since I was born and since my childhood, and I was like born into like pretty modest circumstances, is my mother like always like had like this prophecy that she instilled in me that you are going to like do something for the family, you know, and you're going to be like financially successful at a very young age. Like, you will be smart and capable, but you will experience a crisis and kind of a change of your mindset in the middle of your life to then direct the rest of your life towards like significant humanitarian work. And it's like really interesting because this was like reinforced into me since I was like, since as early as I can remember.
That,
you know,
is
like,
so
this is like a prophecy,
amazing.
You know?
That is, okay, your mom is cool. Like, I need to go get near her so she can be like, Nat, you're on the right path. I mean, I don't know
seriously.
I'm feeling your vibes. I think to be able to say, to have that kind of encouragement and you being able to pull, are you an only child?
No, I have a younger sister.
Okay, so you're the oldest. I just need to, JJ and I love to be like, what's your birth order?
What's your birth order?
You're the oldest.
Well, JJ clearly looks to be the oldest. I mean, she got the most wrinkles.
Oh, that was rough. She always throws out, I'm the oldest. And Natalie is the middle. And we have a younger sister. So there's three of us.
Yes. And I am yellow mustard, Neil. I feel like JJ, you need to understand, if you've watched the videos, JJ's Grey Poupon. I am yellow mustard.
With my mom.
And Emily's the baby. Emily's just the baby, and there is no wrong. So what's the age difference between you and your sister?
3 years.
I love that. Okay. We're all cool.
And you're right. Like, I think birth order matters a lot, you know, it matters a lot in like the, you know, upbringing. Like, sometimes the eldest, like, has a lot of the pressure of, you know, kind of the family in a way. And then like maybe the younger one, it maybe is treated a little bit more with kid gloves in a way. So I've kind of observed that, you know, there's good and bad of all. But yeah, so that's it. That's our like core families. Like, yeah, it's mom and dad and younger sister.
Would you say culturally, cause I think this is important. Do you think culturally care was a priority? Something that was that your family talked about? Was there any kind of assumption? Yeah. Like, of course, because you mentioned you were with your grandparents a lot, which we were too. We grew up with our grandparents and all of our cousins, all of our people. And every Sunday went to church. Everybody got together. We all got fat together. It was great.
Yeah. So, yeah. I think that matters a lot. I think it matters a lot, you know, culturally. Oh, and you know, like an interesting thing you said earlier, where you were talking about, like, you made the joke about hunter-gatherer. So it's actually really interesting. Like, I've thought about this a lot and I've read about this a lot that, you know, human history was a lot more equitable in terms of like the roles of men and women. And if you study how hunter-gatherer tribes operate, it's a lot more egalitarian. Yeah. You know, it's, I think the division of the sexes is a agricultural thing, which is like the last few thousand years of human life where roles were so significantly divided and how you work and who's responsible for what. But I think a lot of like when you study and read about like ancient hunter-gatherer societies, they were way more egalitarian. And some of that is still true today in many different cultures. There's actually a great book I read a few years ago. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it was like a big feminist book in the 1980s called The Chalice and the Blade. Yeah. And I would highly recommend it, you know, if anyone hasn't read it. But it really made me like rethink history because, you know, nowadays it's almost like prevailing view that like there's different types of expectations. But in like studying ancient societies and their writings and, you know, their imagery, there were way more egalitarian civilizations, you know, thousands of years ago. And I think that's kind of something cool. So and anyway, I'll pause there, but I have another thought on
that. No. Yeah. Like that. I have another thought.
Yeah. I have an opinion.
I think culture plays a part, our past experiences play such a significant part in who we are and what was modeled to us. And because we're talking about this, we've never really talked about this before in the sense of I'm a big fan, JJ knows I'm a big fan of Bruce Perry. And he is a psychiatrist, child and adolescent psychiatrist, but talked about how relationships work and how we learned from one another. And when we were in those hunter-gatherer groups, we lived in multi-generational households and the children learned what their roles were at certain ages because they lived in multi-generational households. It was never really a question because they modeled and they observed what they were supposed to do at every age. And I think, you know, we've gotten away from that. You know, technology is a great thing, but it can also we've become a bit more disconnected from our families. And it sounds to me like you were really kind of close to your family growing up, which naturally would I'm sure your parents weren't thinking, will Neil help care for us? Will Neil help, you know, and your sister, will there be questions? And now people really do question, I wonder if my children will help care for me. And then there's this question of, should they?
Yeah. And it goes both ways. It goes both ways too. It's like, I think the thing works when it's like, not that everybody's kind of calculating in a way, but it's kind of like implied of like mutually beneficial, you know, if like grandparents, parents, and children are spending a lot of time with each other, doing things for each other. So there's kind of like an implicit, you know, return, right? And I think the more you kind of like break that down, which you're right, like that is one of the biggest like sadness of the way the modern society is set up. You know, like even now, like I live very close to my parents. Like I live 10 minutes drive away. I live 10 minutes from my sister. And like, we're like very focused on like, you know, I have a young daughter, you know, my sister has two kids. And then like, we see my mom and dad all the time. And it's like, you have to be very conscious about trying to create that because modern society creates a lot of things of somebody gets a job here and they have to move and somebody goes to school here. And then pretty soon, like the family is like kind of broken apart. Yeah, I think you have to be very conscious about that. So yeah, I think that's one of the perils of modern society.
So I know that one of your first experiences, or at least the one that we had talked about in your history, was you helped care for your grandfather as kind of an introduction. So you said you've got a daughter, you've got, of course, you got a spouse. Where does all of this fall? So when did you start taking care of your helping care?
Yes, this was, when I was younger, you know, so now I'm in my early 40s. This was in my early 30s. And, you know, actually, like my grandfather went through like a multi-year, you know, kind of like decline process of, you know, through dementia, through kidney failure, through cancer, and then end of life care. And really, like my family was doing a lot of the care, my mom primarily. And that was kind of like, I'm like the person in the family that everybody relies on for like research and care coordination, just kind of like figure new things out, right?
I like research.
Yeah, that's my strength, right? I'm like an analytical person. I enjoy that. So, you know, there I went through that whole journey. It was my first foray into like direct care. And actually, the biggest realization to me during that point was, you know, because there's a perception that like, even when we were living in India, before we moved here, like American healthcare is awesome, which it is in many ways. But what you realize is that social care which is like a massive component of healthcare, is really lacking. Yeah. You know, so when you are in like, you know, and you guys may have heard this from dementia support groups or cancer support groups, but like, it's like one person doesn't get dementia, the family gets the diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, it's like, okay, yeah, there's some medical stuff that can be done. You know, there's some therapeutics. Now, back then, they weren't even that effective, right? Like nowadays, yeah, there's some that are moderately effective. But like, much of it is like, what's the family gonna do? You know, it's like, home-based care is not really supported. Medicare doesn't cover anything. Like your private health insurance doesn't cover anything. What's the hospital going to do? You know, they're not going to keep somebody around all day, you know, keeping your mom or dad or your grandparents safe.
Yeah.
So that entire thing falls on the family. And that was like my first foray into realizing the social care structure in America is like completely broken. Like it is out of reach and out of affordability for many people to get actual care help. Like whether it's resource navigation, whether it's just having a nice person to give you a break so you can kind of like go do your job. My mom was managing her career at that point.
Wow.
You know, I believe she was in her mid-50s at that time. And it was just like the amount of strain and responsibility was insane. And critically, the realization that we had through that experience is every time we tried to get care support, it was so bad. It was like unreliable. It was high cost. It was really guilt ridden, you know, in terms of like you would leave somebody with him. And, you know, if you came back from work, you know, he's in the room asking for help or a glass of water and somebody's else goofing off in the other room, you know, kind of on their phone or watching TV. And, you know, I don't want to knock the care workers of America. You know, I believe there are very well-intentioned people who are doing great work in this field and many people who do view it as a calling. But I think it's really the economic structure of the care industry that care work, which is some of the most important work in someone's life, right? Especially for the person who is receiving the care, is treated, and I have the same view on education too. It's some of the lowest paid work in the country, which is that should be a damning of the society, you know, that this is how we value care for our, not just older population. This is how we value care for our children. This is how we value care for middle-aged people going through cancer and children with disabilities. These are some of the lowest paying jobs in the country. And that is like an absolute tragedy because what happens when the job is low paying? It's not done well, or that person is super stressed out that they did a night shift last night doing something else. And then they're coming in during the day because they can't make ends meet. So it is really, I think the structure of the care system is so bad that you cannot blame the care workers. I think you have to blame the system.
I think you're exactly right. We're over our time. I'm going to jump into a break because I want to jump back into this because I think what we're doing is we're talking about direct care and your own experience, but we're also sprinkling in macro level issues. And when I say macro for our listeners, we're talking about system issues, the healthcare system and why there's so much flaw. And when you're in the thick of it, you're trying to figure out why is this so dang hard to navigate? Well, because the system is dysfunctional.
Yes.
It's not you, I promise. It's not you.
Thanks for bringing that up. Because a lot of times I thought, what am I missing? Like I'm not researching it enough. I haven't found the right option. Maybe I'll do more work and find something else. A lot of times you feel very isolated, especially if it's your first rodeo going through care. You're just like, I must be doing something wrong. You know, why am I not finding good help?
Exactly. Which never helps. But we will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
All right, everybody, we are back here with Neil Shaw. And let me tell you something, we're on our soapbox. So I'm sorry, we're talking about some macro level issues, but also Neil mentioned something that really touched me. And the truth is that you always kind of feel like it's your fault. Like, what am I doing wrong? When actually it's some bigger issues. And you see that when you're a caregiver. And I know some of that stuff has really inspired you to get where you are today to kind of, I don't want to give the spoiler alert, but Neil quit his job. But go ahead, Nat.
Let's talk about the first instance of care because you've had multiple bouts and it changed actually the trajectory like your mother knew. This goes back to your mother was right.
She was. Yeah.
Let's talk about like this happens. Your grandfather starts getting dementia and what's the family conversation like? Let's get back into the personal and say, okay, how did we have this conversation? You're in your late 20s, 30, early 30s at this point. What, tell us about that and what had the planning been for that, for your grandparents and that sort of thing?
Planning close to minimal, you know, like it's not like something you kind of, I mean, maybe some people plan for, but, you know, kind of unexpectedly happens to you. The family conversation was, how are you going to manage the care, right? Like in that case, like everybody's working. My mom was working. So, you know, it was like, okay, let's get care help. How do we keep him safe? You know, at various times, how do we take him to dialysis appointments? You know, like there was a lot of like coordination work. And we were trying to kind of patch it all together and suddenly learn all together about how do you get help? Who do you hire? How do you vet? All that stuff. you know, full transparency. And part of the reason why I really am focused on why the system is broken, a lot of times we just thought we were just having bad luck, or we're doing it wrong. We're not getting good help. My mom ended up taking a lot of time off work, like just unexpectedly missing work here and there, then having to take breaks and take leave.
Oh, yeah.
I cut to the end. I mean, eventually she just left her career and did it full time herself because it was so bad, you know, which like we thought, okay, why is this happening? You know, how is not, I don't, you know, when you're in the situation, you don't think this must not be happening to everyone. Otherwise, everybody must be quitting their, you know, work. So maybe we're just not figuring out where the good care is. But yeah, so there was like a real toll on that. And then I would say the bigger thing from the whole observational experience was it put so much strain and pressure on my mom through the care journey that after he passed, I think there was a long period of PTSD, for her to recover from that because of just the combination of the sheer amount of work and the sheer amount of second guessing and guilt of like, could I have done XYZ things better?
Wow.
So I think that was like, I mean, obviously on me too, you know, but I unfortunately didn't have a lot of time to think because shortly after that, my wife became severely ill, and then it's like directly hit me.
Oh, and when it hits you, it's weird because it's, you mentioned in the information that you sent us, you were like, I was the secondary caregiver. And so it's interesting that your mom was the primary. Is that, would you say that was between she and your dad? Like, well, one, let me reverse. Is your grandfather maternal or?
It was her dad.
Okay, so it was her dad. And so was it, and so then it would have been assumed like your dad, you're a female, this is the natural role. And everybody just was like, okay, best supporting actress.
In that case, there's two siblings, like it's her and her older sister.
Yeah.
And I think it was assumed like, just from a personality perspective, like my mom is like way more of the caring person. Yeah. So it was kind of assumed that way, you know, that like she would do it.
Oh, trust me, Neil, JJ and Emily are way more caring than me. Like I'm the fourth person out of three daughters my mom would probably ask for. And but I think this is important for our listeners to hear. Just because you're the oldest doesn't mean you're automatically nominated to be the caregiver. Just because it really leans into a number of factors. It's not as clean as a diagnostic, you know, as a diagnosis, if you think about it. It's not that clean. So like, it's about based on a number of factors. Where do you live? Who's got the personality? What's the relationship like? Can you even do it? I mean, if you really think about it, what were some of the roles, if you don't mind, before we go in to talk about your wife, what were some of the roles that you played being really a caregiver to the caregiver, not only just to you supporting your grandfather, but even supporting your mom, how you and your sister.
And thanks for sharing that. You know, I would say actually in like reflecting on it, probably not as much of an emotional support role and more of like a outsourced helper or researcher role, you know, because like, that's what I'm good at. You know, I would say, you know, like based on my own personality, I was like, okay, what can I do given the skills and the, you know, energy that I have and what kind of things am I not good at or like maybe less naturally good at? So I played a role of like, let me take tasks off your plate and help you figure things out because I like doing that and I'm good at it.
So you have this experience, you're moving along at the same time in your career. So you get married at some point, like you're a whiz kid. I mean, basically you're Doogie Howser of the finance.
Yeah.
That's what I've decided. You're Doogie Howser of the finance. And so life's like moving along, you get married, meet your wife, and then what happens?
Yes, I got married. Yeah, I met my wife, got married. And, you know, we were married for, I think, around less than 3 years at the time when she became severely ill. And, you know, went through breast cancer. It was triple negative, very fast growing K factor. And yeah, went through a major series of health issues, including multiple hospitalizations, a lot of side effects from treatments that weren't working, multiple surgeries at like very early on, went through a severe hospitalization that landed her ultimately in the ICU in a medical coma for 3 weeks with like bilateral pneumonia with sepsis. So like at one point had like over 50% probability of death. And, you know, I was like kind of thrust into direct caregiving through that experience at the time that I had achieved like the pinnacle of my career, you know, where I'd been working my butt off since my early 20s. And by the time I was 35, I was running a $250 million investment fund, you know, with me as like the kind of the main person that the investors had invested with. And then I had a team of people working with me. So yeah, it was like extremely, extremely sudden. And it was like a tremendous amount of pressure where that work itself was very stressful. You know, I was already working 60, 70 plus hours a week on that. And then I was thrust into these emergent situations, managing my wife's care of, oh, by the way, she's in a coma. You have to make all the medical decisions. And I'm like basically just living at the hospital for close to a month. And I'm like full sabbatical of like, I'm not doing work.
Does everyone know? I know you're the head, but have you fully disclosed like all of these health issues? Or it's like, no, you don't want to talk about
it. I've my team knows to an extent, but mm-hmm. I'm not trying to scare them, you know, because like this is all their livelihoods, you know, so I don't want them to panic. I got it under control.
You got a lot of pressure there because you just said this is their livelihoods and I'm the lead.
Yes. It's like, there's a lot of responsibility because think about it, like at that time, okay, like a lot of things in your life could collapse, right? Like you've built something that is paying a lot of people's salaries and you have to disappear for a month, which is like not easy to do like a relatively smaller organization. So you have to like have responsibility for like, okay, you know, these people need to make sure they have a stability of like a way to earn a living. At the same time, your wife is in a situation where she cannot make medical decisions and several medical decisions had to be made on treatment. And you are now suddenly, you know, at an age of 35, legally, you are the person deciding somebody else's medical fate and you're trying to calculate and think about what to do. And like, I didn't come from like medical background. So I was like, well, if I do this and she survives or this and she doesn't survive, it's like, can you imagine like the amount of stress, like
that
if you make the wrong call or you make even the right call and it just goes the wrong way, you'll have to live with that for the rest of your life, you know? And that's like somebody else's life that you're accountable for. And they didn't give you any training. And the different doctors are like giving different recommendations. You know, I would ask many of them, what would you do? And, you know, one of them would say one thing and then the person at night would say another thing. And I was like, I mean, it's like really, if I don't know if you guys have ever been in these situations, it's like extremely, extremely stressful because you don't know what the right call is.
Well, and I'll say this, I know that, you know, Jason, most people know that Jason had head and neck cancer, but what they don't know is 10 years ago, he had back issues and and it was, do we have a back surgery that could basically impact him in a very different way permanently? And because he was 49. Or do we not? And so we went with three opinions because we thought three, there's a reason boards have odd numbers.
I break.
We made the decision based on, well, what did two out of the three say? 66% decided that this was the way to go. I'm gonna pause this for a second and take one more break, and then we're going to keep on going. So we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
All right, everybody, we are back here with Neil Shah, and we're talking about decisions that can alter someone else's life that you have to live with the rest of your life, basically. Your wife has had multiple health issues. She's been in the hospital. And tell me, we know that you're really you're sharing a little bit at work, but not a whole lot because you don't want to scare anybody. Tell me how you move through this situation, what it teaches you, but also what you do with it. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think, I moved through it, I think kind of like best I could one step at a time at the moment of like, how do you manage and navigate the care? But like ultimately I ended up taking like sabbatical, then going back to work, then sabbatical, going back to work. And like ultimately just made a very difficult decision to kind of like wind down the fund because I felt like I could not responsibly continue the work. That was like a very, very difficult drawn out decision. You know, it was almost like admitting defeat, you know, after like I've worked that hard to get to kind of like pinnacle of my career and have earned the respect of a lot of like friends, colleagues, people I've known, you know, for a couple of decades, to then just like make the difficult decision to walk away was like very isolating and very sad. But I thought that it would have a big impact on like my wife's health outcome because it was like touch and go for a while on what would happen. Yeah, I think that the other kind of some of the other things like I learned during the process was like it was very isolating, like as a middle-aged, like not even middle-aged, I guess mid-30s man in New York City, there was not a lot of, I'd say not in a bad way, but there wasn't as much empathy as I would have expected. I think it's because of like the way society is. A lot of people, I found a lot of like young or men in their 30s or 40s kind of maybe have a more, I don't know what the right word is, but more old school way of thinking about care that, okay, that, oh, why are you doing that? You know, why isn't somebody else doing that? So I think they
nobody
have like-
Nobody asked you where are her parents at? Why aren't her parents helping you with this?
Yeah, I think some, yeah, exactly.
Like people could say, is there another woman that you could find to help you with that? And it doesn't sound sexist, but it's really true because nobody questioned me when I'm caring for Jason. But if Jason were caring for me, they'd be like, oh, and I know JJ would probably be, well, she's going to step in either way. She stepped in either way. But should we find another? It's almost like, should we find a woman?
Yeah, I think it's like, I think, yeah, that kind of stuff is like, maybe said like, in, like they wouldn't say that exactly to my face that way, but it's implied. It's implied. And then I think the other thing that was kind of interesting also is like from a stage of life perspective, typically at that stage, okay, for 35, like a lot of our friends, and this is where I would say give them the grace that maybe it's not their fault. Many of them are at a phase in their life where a lot of my friends had also recently gotten married or maybe had been married for a few years. Many of them were having children. And we had gotten married. We did not have children at that time. So while their life is kind of in this trajectory of, hey, I'm entering a new phase of life, of like I'm going from, like so many of my male friends were like single male to then marriage to then kids. And I'm the one at the group dinner talking about, oh, my wife's really sick. Oh, yeah, this treatment didn't work. Oh, yeah, I'm making these decisions. It's almost like you become kind of like the Debbie Downer.
Oh my God, I almost said Debbie Downer. I thought that's going to come across harsh, but it's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a reality. You know, it's like, hey, I don't have anything fun to report. Somebody's like, oh, I just had a kid. Oh man, I'm doing this thing. Oh, I'm doing this thing. I'm like, well, I've now walked away from my career and things are not going well health-wise and I'm super stressed out. So it's like, who wants to,
Hang out with Neil.
Not to blame them. Yeah, seriously. It's like, I can see that they're like, oh, hey, this sucks because all my positive stuff in the group of five or six people, it's like, okay, this person's only talking about the stress that they're having. So I'd say give people the benefit of the doubt. You could see why there's like a little bit of more of a distance. You know, while people are very empathetic and supportive, like tons of people sent us food, flowers, you know, visited, you know, and checked in on us, whatever. But there was still that like a little bit of unspoken thing of like, look, I'm at a phase in my life where things are looking up. I don't want to hear all this negative stuff all the time. And I get that. You know, I think this is a big thing in like human psychology of like sometimes people just don't want to hear about bad things, even though that's a reality of everyone's life, whether it happens to you at 35 or 70 or 50 or anywhere in between. There's going to be difficult things that happen in your life. But many times people have like less appetite for, tolerating that. So yeah, I found it became like extremely isolating, extremely, extremely isolating. And especially when she had left her work, I had left my work and there was just like illness and challenges to go through. It was like a very difficult and lonely time, for a while.
So let me ask you this. I thought you were going to lean in, Jay, for a second. I didn't want to step over top of you like I always do. Kind of thinking about, I appreciate the conversation that we just had about, you really gave people permission to be able to kind of step back. How much of that was your own stuff in saying, respectfully, and this is where it comes back to reluctant caregiver. I mean, truly, I mean, none of us want, let's be really clear. None of us want to be caregivers because we want our original role. You wanted to be a husband. You wanted to be a grandson. You know what I mean? Like, it's not that we don't want to do care, but we don't want to be put in that role because of what it really ultimately means. And there's a lot of loss of control, but you're given a lot of, like you said out loud, probably what a lot of people think and they don't want to say out loud, but how much of that, are you sure you didn't put any of what your own, like, maybe I would feel this way, or I assume they're feeling this way and nobody ever said it. Do you know what I mean? How much of that did you put on others to say, I'm going to pull myself back some because I don't think they want to hear it because hell, I don't want to hear it. I mean, that's what I did. I didn't think anybody would want to hear it because I'm depressing.
No, good question. Good question. I'll say this, actually, interestingly enough, one thing I discovered through the care journey, which I guess maybe is like counterintuitive, I actually like being a caregiver. You know, I like the act of giving care, which is like very surprising to me because like up until that moment of life, I view myself as like just highly analytical person.
Yeah.
Sometimes maybe not in tune with my emotions and stuff like that. But I like being a caregiver. You know, I like helping somebody, you know, whether it's like a close family member or even just somebody not. I like the act of like helping somebody who's suffering or struggling. So the act of care, I enjoyed. And I mean, that's saying that loosely. There were a lot of times of high, high stress, you know, but I like and find deep meaning in the work, you know, whether it's within family or for someone else. But I also, like, I would say I'm attuned to other people's like feelings and kind of the way they're interacting. And I think that like, yeah, I will talk about the stress of it and, hey, this is what happened. And I could just read the room that it was kind of like, no one would explicitly say it to your face.
Yeah.
But it was like reading the room that, yeah, people just like have a limited tolerance of hearing about it when they're in a certain phase of life, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it was like more like, I don't think people, but you're right. Like maybe it's me misreading it, but I could just tell that people would be a little bit more guarded of like, I think frankly, many of them would be like, I don't know what to say, you know, because I think many of them have not gone through that experience, you know?
So Neil, I know that you're my neighbor, basically. So tell me about, somehow you have transitioned. You left New York City. So tell me how all of this occurred, because you left your career very successful. Yeah. And some people may say, this man was crazy, first of all.
Why would he give up all that money? Because that's really what I know. Like, he's successful. He's doing this. He's living a great life.
Tell me how you, what all this meant to you and how you made this change in your life that fulfilled your mom's prophecy, basically.
Thanks. Yeah. I through my wife's care journey, so I initially like had to, because it was just, there's so much care to do, and there's so much care, responsibility, and such a impact on the outcome that I was like, if I do the care myself, and I'm like there at all the oncology visits, I'm kind of like there thinking, researching, maybe there will be a better probability of beating the cancer. So, you know, end up kind of like really just going all out and obsessing over it. You know, then, you know, knock on wood, you know, and part of that whole journey was just like kind of coming back home, getting care support from extended family. And then, you know, actually, you know, she had her final surgery here at Duke. And, you know, then, you know, after radiation, like was in remission, which was like awesome outcome after all these difficult years. Yeah. And at that point, you know, I left out of necessity of like the immediate, like emergent situation of like, have to leave because that'll impact the outcome. But then after, you know, she had recovered, then I spent a lot of time like soul searching and thinking, okay, I could just go back into what I was doing and, you know, may not be able to pick it up exactly where I left it, but pretty quickly kind of get back there.
Yeah.
But I'll say fully, honestly, it was like eye-opening life experience in a way of like, it made me second guess what I had been doing with my life previously. Like I have a lot of skills. I have like a very hard work ethic, you know, and like I have like brain power that I can like dedicate to something. And then I'd realize like the initial reason for entering that industry was just because I came from like lower income background. I was like, okay, how can I just quickly make a bunch of money so I don't have to like worry about finances for myself or even for my parents, you know, for their retirement. But then you realize like, what's the point beyond a certain point? There's no point. You know, it's like, I'm not a very materially interested person. I don't have like big tastes or anything. I don't like to buy expensive things. So then it was like, what's the point? You know, just because you're in something, you're just kind of going down because of momentum, but like, you're not. So I think when you have this traumatic experience, at least for me, it leads to a lot of like soul searching of like, one, you're face to face with your loved one's mortality, but you're also face to face and makes you think about your own mortality.
That's right.
You know, like if I were to die next year, what will I have spent my precious time on earth doing? At that point, I wouldn't have been proud of that. You know, I would have been like, okay, cool, I did something. But that was like a really not best use of the talents and the energy that I have. So that was like really the catalyst of like, okay, that combined with, I've been in so many caregiver support groups and talked to so many people that are dealing with this situation. As bad as I felt for myself of having to walk away from a career, I was like, well, like a lot of people have it way, way worse. You know, of like people have walked away from careers where they don't have a fallback, they don't have savings, they're taking care of their loved one, and then they're just going to be completely screwed on their own after that. So I think that years of that journey and talking to so many people, it's like been like an awakening of like just how bad the system is. So yeah, it was like after a lot of like thinking, it was like, okay, I want to like dedicate my life's work to fixing this to the best that I can. Of like caregiving is very difficult. It's the system is so broken that I was like, okay, let me just like put my energy into that and just kind of go.
Your level of empathy is just amazing. Cause you said you were in these groups, these caregiving groups, first of all, and you say, I see these people that had it worse than I did. And you think about that.
So what started first? Was it Care Yaya? Cause that's how I came to know you. What started first?
Yeah, that started kind of Care Yaya. Like it was like, I was like, what can I do given everything that I've seen and experienced myself and everything I'm seeing caregivers go through? So initially, you know, I kind of went through like a lot of like ideas of like, okay, where is there the biggest impact you can make? You know, I think you guys are right. Like there's a, you know, looking back, there is like an amount of like naive optimism that I think sometimes is required, because don't get me wrong, it has not been easy. It has
easy.
I got in and I realized it's broken for a reason. And like, I just underestimated how uphill of the battle it is. But sometimes if you don't have that naive optimism, you never get started, you know? So, I had kind of like this naive optimism of like, you know, a series of challenges that I'd experienced, I'd seen other people experience. But I think some of them being caregivers having a hard time getting a break. A lot of times the caregiver just needs an ability to somebody else to take the the burden off them so that they can go do something for themselves, whether it's they have to go work for income or whether it's they have to take a break to just spend time on their own. I felt like that was like kind of, given that I didn't come from like a medical background, the quickest thing I could make an impact on was finding a way for caregivers to kind of get that help. And given that I'd navigated the entire care system myself of like everything from like getting help through agencies, informally finding caregivers, you know, actually had experience like even hiring students, like I'd kind of gone through the whole thing, and I'd gone through a lot of people that I've met over the years in support groups, try every single thing possible. I'd kind of observed that the lived experience, that the best thing in that kind of underground economy of care was people already knew. Finding students, you know, finding really most of the time it was like contacting your local nursing school's professor and finding students who are empathetic and want to do this work, and then managing it yourself. Like everybody knew. It was like a well-kept secret that that is some of the best care, but it's a lot of manual work for you to do. And I think almost to the person in the care economy, most people knew the hiring care through these agencies. I don't want to offend anyone. You know, I appreciate people are doing these and running these businesses, but most people knew that the agency-based care was just like not great, but like they were like, that's the best I got. I don't have the time to manage all this myself. So that was like really kind of the inspiration of like starting CareAI. I was like, I think there's a way to help people solve this problem. And I think there's a way to do it both affordably and to do it in a high quality way, mainly because when you experience low quality care, you feel very guilty. Like if you go do your job because you left your mom, dad, spouse, whoever with kind of a subpar caregiver, you carry that guilt with you to your job and you think about it all day. And you may, and many people have to learn repressing mechanisms because you don't have a choice. You know, I think that's like modern life we live in. But I think that has like a second order impact on the person. They know, you know, they know and they feel bad. You know, they feel bad that I wish I could have done better, but what choice do I have? So I really wanted to fix that because I think that guilt has a lot of.
Well, guilt is also then the next step is isolation. So you started CareYaya, which is, this is how I found you. And I thought it was really cool. And then you decided, no, I think I'll do some other things too. Cause not like that wasn't successful enough, but let's go ahead and let's go to the next level.
I know. Well, okay. So I totally glossed over what CareYaya is. So basically, I started CareYaya, which is like a social impact project, which was basically how do we connect people with great caregivers at like the most logically affordable rates. So we run completely for free. Like CareAI charges no fees, markups, anything like that. And initially it was just like funding it myself. And it was like, we built this technology system similar to like Uber or Airbnb or whatever you want to call it. And we said, if anyone is caring for a family member, you can go to the site and you will get wonderful healthcare students near you. So we started in our area in Raleigh, Durham. So at like Duke and UNC Chapel Hill and NC State. Yep. And, you know, pre-med students, nursing students.
You were in a good place for it. Let's be clear.
Yes.
UNC, North Carolina has, and Virginia is honestly another one, has a good college system that allows for you to pull interns and students that are in the healthcare track. So I think that's an important component to it. I think it'd be harder in some of your more rural states.
Yes, 100% agree. The South, you know, a lot of the South has a disproportionate number of, you know, college students and also a disproportionate number of older adults. Yeah. So, you know, that was kind of like a really like realization. So we started that and we've been now running CareAI for about 3 years and it started from like a local Raleigh Durham thing with like a couple hundred students at Duke and UNC to eventually got to like 1,000 to eventually, you know, got to like 5,000. And now it's spread nationally. We have now, I think at last count, like 44,000 students across, we're at over 35 universities. It's like really cool. It's
Neil.
Yeah,
Just a little thing.
Yeah, it's like blown up. And it's like really cool because like it's in most markets, it's the most affordable care option by like 30 to 40%. You know, in areas like Boston, you know, the local care companies are charging $42 to $45 an hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you know, no offense to anyone, but most of the caregivers are not doing a great job in those situations because they're not getting paid most. That the interesting break in the care economy is that the caregiver does like 99.9% of the hard work, right?
Sorry.
They're actually on the job doing it. The care matching organization, which would be the company, is doing like 1%, maybe at best, of the work, which is like upfront marketing and sales and administrative work. But the economic value that these companies are capturing is over half. So in Boston, the care company is charging 45 and capturing 25 to 30 of that, and then paying the care worker like teens on per hour.
That's unbelievable.
So that's why the care sucks. And that's why the family pays an arm and a leg. So what CareAI does is we will connect you with pre-med student at Harvard, nursing student at Tufts, whoever, you know, kind of is available for $20 an hour. And then you pay and the student gets, and we fund the whole thing off grants and social impact funders. And that I think is like a big change in the care economy because the caregivers are super happy, motivated. They're getting paid reasonably well. The family is like able to afford a lot of care. So a lot of people we serve could not afford care in a traditional way. And yeah, the impact is scaling now around the country with like a pretty lean team. And I think that's kind of like a cool, you know, both sides win.
Again, if you don't know CareYaya, and I know for our listeners on UK Health Radio, this is a United States based, but this is a concept that I'm sure Neil was like, oh, people, it's anywhere kind of idea. You can do this. And so I think my answer is be inspired. And so, because that's
we might expand to the UK. We have BBC is going to do a story on us there. I'm doing an interview with BBC like next week. So
coming to the UK soon.
Yeah. We'll see. Fingers crossed.
Oh, please. Are you kidding me? It's not even a question. This has been, you know, I'm going to tell you, this has been the most interesting conversation. I'm going to give you one question, Jay, because you got one sister question.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you for making everything to the caregivers at no charge. We have a big heart for caregivers and they don't have a lot of extra funds. First of all, that was my first thing.
I absolutely love that.
You could not all about free. We're all about that. First, question, one thing that you that big overwhelming goal that you want to see happen for the insurance, for the healthcare industry?
What does the future look like? Oh yeah. Like,
what do you want to see? What is the one, what healthcare for healthcare in general? What do you want to see?
Okay. Yeah. For healthcare in general, I think my maybe one overarching philosophical goal is the recognition of the family caregiver as the largest healthcare workforce in the country. That I think that people who are caregiving do not get the respect they deserve. Like, they are doing literally frontline, they are the frontline doctors and nurses in millions of homes across America. That's partly why I wear scrubs, like whether it's to inspire the students or to inspire the family caregivers, that this is America's healthcare workforce. It's 63 million people by latest count from AARP that they are doing American healthcare. And they're keeping not just the healthcare system afloat, but they, we, all of us, right? Like, we are keeping the society afloat. And I think that caregivers would be behooved to be better supported. You know, like, think about how much money our healthcare system is $5 trillion economy. Like, the amount of money we're paying for drugs, the amount of money we're paying to hospitals, the amount of money that the Medicare Advantage plans and health insurance plans are making in profit. And what are the family caregivers getting? Absolutely nothing. You know, I think it's like unbelievable, like, unfairness in the system that, you know, if somebody in your family is sick, you don't get anything. You know, like, they pay $32,000 a year to Biogen for this dementia drug. Why isn't $32,000 available to the family to decide, do I want to take the drug or do I want to pay for care, whether it's to pay fractional care or the family member to get paid if they have to quit their job? So I think that a big overarching change would be like that the millions of people who are like the actual hidden healthcare workforce get the recognition and support they deserve and get like the financial support they deserve.
Oh, I'm going to tell you, like, we could just go on and on and on. Neil, I'm going to ask you the absolute last question.
Okay.
Absolutely. And this is the flippant question of the entire conversation because we've been super serious. But what, I don't know when you have free time because I feel like, oh, look, Neil works more than me. But in your free time, what do you do just for you? What is your guilty pleasure? What's the thing you do for you?
My guilty, I love to read. I know that sounds cheesy, but I love to read random stuff. Like I love to read books about all kinds of like, you know, like neuroscience of like how the brain works. Yes. Where is consciousness? I love to read a lot of like philosophy books. I love to read a lot about ancient history, you know, kind of what were cultures like in the past. Yeah. I just like, I love to read any kind of random. Yeah. So if you guys have any book recommendations, let me know.
Oh, friend. But that's my Neil kind of like guilty is pleasure. Is like, he's a sponge.
You are a sponge. Yeah. I'm going to send you some book recommendations because from the psych side, but it's all neuroscience. And so I think it's things that it's really about relationship and connection and how do we come more together. And you're really demonstrating how you can make technology work to help humankind. And so I love that. I love that. So Jay, you want to close us
Natalie?
Out?
Neil, thank you guys so much. And everybody else, all our listeners, until we confess again, we will see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Well, friends, that's a wrap on this week's confession. Thank you so much for listening in on UK Health Radio. But before you go, please take a moment to leave us a review and tell your friends about the Confession Show. Don't forget, visit our website to sign up for our newsletter and connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Pinterest, and Twitter. You'll also find the video recording of all our episodes on the Confessions website and our YouTube channel. We'll see you next Tuesday when we come together to confess again. Till then, take care of you.